We looked pretty heavily last week at Jeconiah and tried to reconcile some of the different texts that that mention Jeconiah. He was the son of Jehoiakim. Jeconiah's other name is Jehoiachin. And I pronounce that CH pretty purposefully because in the Hebrew, it's a lot of fun, the differences between Jehoiachin and Jehoiakim. So the letter is very, very close, but it's just a subtle difference between like a guttural CH sound and a K. But Jehoiakim is the son of Josiah, who ruled back here. Jehoahaz was Josiah's son, and he was put on the throne by the people. He wasn't probably the anointed king, but the people put him on the throne, and he was very quickly deposed by the king of Egypt, Pharaoh. And so when Jehoahaz was deposed and taken off to Egypt, the king of Egypt put Jehoiakim on the throne. He was confirmed by Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, when he came to Jerusalem just before the Battle of Carchemish. And Jehoiakim served Babylon for 3 years, and then he rebelled. And so after he rebelled against Babylon, Babylon came back and besieged the city and just about destroyed Judah, took the city of Jerusalem, and Jehoiakim was killed, and then Jeconiah was put on the throne. But when Babylon conquered Jerusalem that time, Jehoiachin, also Jeconiah, was deported and taken to Babylon, along with a whole bunch of other people. Now, we talked quite a bit about Jeconiah and his relationship to Jehoiakim, and we said there's some evidence that though Jeconiah is the physical son of Jehoiakim, he was actually adopted by Josiah. Because our passage in Matthew, the genealogical list of Jesus' lineage, lists Jeconiah as a son of Josiah. And we looked also at the other passages that talk about Zedekiah being Jeconiah's uncle, and another passage says his brother. So we said, in what scenario could Jeconiah, who we know is physically born to Jehoiakim, also be a brother to these guys? And it would be that if Josiah adopted him legally, then he would be, legally speaking, Josiah's son, but physically speaking, the son of Jehoiakim. So interestingly enough, too, Jeconiah goes off into captivity in Babylon, and Ezekiel the prophet, who is also in Babylon at this point, dates all of his prophecies by the exile of Jeconiah, kind of signifying to us that along with the genealogy in Matthew, since the genealogy in Matthew lists Jeconiah as a son of Jehoiakim and traces Jesus, as a son of Josiah, Matthew traces Jesus' lineage back through Jeconiah and not to Jehoiakim, but to Josiah. So that would tell us that Jeconiah is actually the rightful king. Not his dad, Jehoiakim, not Jehoahaz, and not Zedekiah, because Jeconiah is alive in Babylon in captivity, but Zedekiah is sitting on the throne of Judah, but Ezekiel dates all of his prophecies to the years of Jeconiah's reign. And so that tells us that in God's estimation, Jeconiah was the legitimate king. Okay. So Jeconiah has been hauled off to Babylon. We saw that in the last part of chapter 24. We pick up in 2 Kings 24, verse 18. And it says, Zedekiah was 21 years old when he became king. He reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna. Now that, I'm sure that rings a bell because everybody remembers these fun names, right? But if you go back to chapter 23 and verse 31, we're going to look at when Jehoahaz, the son of Josiah, took the throne. And it says, Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 3 months in Jerusalem. His mother's name was? Same thing. Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna. So that tells us that Zedekiah was actually a full brother of Jehoahaz. These two guys, both the sons of the same woman and the son of King Josiah. Okay. So he takes the throne. He's 21 years old. Verse 19, this is chapter 24, verse 19. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that Jehoiakim had done. For because of the anger of the Lord, it came to the point in Jerusalem and Judah that he cast them out from his presence. And Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. Zedekiah serves Babylon for a little while, but then he's going to rebel against him again. And I like to try to draw in from the different resources in the Bible to show how these all intersect. So I want you to turn to Jeremiah 51. So turn to Jeremiah chapter 51. And we're looking at verses 59 through 64. So Jeremiah 51, verses 59 through 64. And it says, "The word that Jeremiah the prophet commanded Seraiah, the son of Neriah, son of Maaseiah, when he went with Zedekiah, king of Judah, to..." Well, we're still turning pages. Where does it say that Zedekiah the king went? To Babylon, in the fourth year of his reign. So right here, in the fourth year of Zedekiah's reign, Zedekiah makes a visit to Babylon. And that's where Ezekiel's at. That's also where Jeconiah has been imprisoned. So Zedekiah makes a trip to Babylon for some reason. We're not told what it is. But this prophecy from Jeremiah is important. He wrote in the book all the disaster that should come upon Babylon. All these words that are written concerning Babylon. And verse 61, Jeremiah said to Seraiah, "When you come to Babylon, see that you read all these words and say, 'O Lord, you have said concerning this place that you will cut it off so that nothing shall dwell in it, neither man nor beast, and it shall be desolate forever.' When you finish reading this book, tie a stone to it, cast it in the midst of the Euphrates, and say, 'Thus shall Babylon sink to rise no more because of the disaster that I am bringing upon her, and they shall become exhausted.'" So that's God's prophecy given to Jeremiah about Babylon, which again, at this point in history, Babylon is at its power peak. Nebuchadnezzar is conquering nation after nation. He's conquered Israel. He's conquered Assyria. He's conquered Egypt. He's conquered just about everything in his path. So for God to step in and say, "Yeah, this is all going to be destroyed," looks like foolishness. But we know that God can declare the end from the beginning. God has no trouble in seeing what's going to happen in the next 25 or 50 years. And so he says to Zedekiah, everything's going to be destroyed. So back to 2 Kings. And we're in chapter 25 now. It says, "In the ninth year of his reign," that's the reign of Zedekiah, "he sits on the throne for 11 years, so we're in the ninth year. We're getting near the end of it. "The 10th month, on the 10th day of the month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came with all his army against Jerusalem and laid siege to it." Why is he back to destroy Jerusalem yet again? This is the third siege of Jerusalem, by the way. We had a siege back here in 601 in which Israel became a servant to Babylon. We had a siege in 597, and we're having this one here that starts in 588. Why is Babylon back again? Eldon? Right. Zedekiah is no longer sending the tribute money along that he's supposed to. And so Babylon has said, "That's it, you guys have had enough chances, I'm done with all your rebelliousness, and I'm going to put you down." So Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came with all his army against Jerusalem and laid siege to it, and they built siege works all around it. So the city was besieged until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. On the 9th day of the 4th month, the famine was so severe in the land that there was no food for the people of the land. So when does the siege start? Well, that's true. I'm sorry. What time of the year? The 10th month, right. So the beginning of the Hebrew year is sometime in March or April, which means the 10th month is going to be when? Cold time. Yeah, you're talking December, January, right? Okay. Do armies normally go to battle in the winter? Germany, yeah, don't go to the Russian front in the wintertime, right? Don't attack Russia in the winter. What does that tell you about how serious of a thing this is in Nebuchadnezzar's eyes? That he's willing to take his army on the march to get to Jerusalem in the wintertime. Normally, the armies would stay put from about October, November, all the way up through springtime. And it was in spring that you started waging war again. But Nebuchadnezzar shows up on Jerusalem's doorstep in the dead of winter and starts building siege works. It could possibly be a tactical decision to say, hey, they're low on food already, so let's go attack them now. There's probably also a little bit of... Babylon had to conquer the outlying cities first, the fortified cities, what few of them were left, and then they came to Jerusalem. But here it is, it starts in the 10th month, on the 10th day of the month. And what's our next time marker in verse 3? So we start in the 9th year of Zedekiah's reign, and verses 2 and 3 give us another date. Yeah, the 11th year. Yeah, there's no more beyond. Dan's looking up at our timeline saying, wait a second, there's nothing beyond the 11th year, right? So you start... If we imagine a little bit of a wheel here for our months of the year, you start here in December or January, the 10th month, and that's the 9th year. In March, you go into Zedekiah's 10th year, because the beginning of the year is in March, April. Then you come around until we hit the 11th year, so the siege has been going on for at least one full year. Then in January or so, and then we hit March again, and we go to Zedekiah's 11th year, and now we got to go into the 4th month. So 4 months from March, April brings us to hot. Yeah, we're in the middle of summer now. We're in July, August. So we're in July, August of the siege. The siege has been going on for a year and a half of actual time. You can count it as 3 calendar years that this siege has been happening. And it says, the famine is so severe in the city, there is no food for the people of the land. Verse 4, then a breach was made in the city, and all the men of war fled by night by the way of the gate between the two walls, by the king's garden. And the Chaldeans were around the city. And they went in the direction of the Arabah. The Arabah is the south land, the desert land south of Judah. So, all right, you are... a resident of Jerusalem, and remember that all of the craftsmen have been deported to Babylon already. Okay, 10,000 plus people were taken off back here in 597, 596 when the second siege was ended. And that's when Ezekiel was taken captive. All of the skilled men, many of the mighty men of war were taken. And Jerusalem was left with just the lower class of people, the average workers. So you go to bed at night, you're under siege, you're hungry because there's nothing left to eat, very little left to drink. But at least you look up on the walls and you see some soldiers keeping watch on the walls and up in the towers, right? And then you get up in the morning and they're all gone. And there's a little crack in the wall. And the king is gone, all of the leaders are gone, and what you have left of your small military is gone. How do you feel about that, Eldon? Scared. Yeah, scared. A little betrayed, maybe. Hey, our leaders just turned tail and fled, and they left us here to die. Wonderful. Yeah, not the best leadership, huh? So somehow they sneak their way through the Chaldean camp that surrounds the city. Verse 5, but the army of the Chaldeans pursued the king and overtook him in the plains of Jericho, and all his army was scattered from him. How do you think the king feels now?
More betrayed.
Because your soldiers just fled, right? They're fleeing for their lives. Verse 6, they captured the king. They brought him up to the king of Babylon at Riblah, and they passed sentence on him. So Riblah is not too far of a march from Jerusalem. So the king of Babylon would have had his pavilions and things set up a little bit away from the battle, and his generals would have been executing the battle daily. So they take him back to Riblah, and they pass sentence on him. Verse 7, they slaughtered the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes. They put out the eyes of Zedekiah and bound him in chains and took him to Babylon. Harsh? Well, you know, if you are the king of an empire like Nebuchadnezzar, you don't take it well when lesser kings rebel against you. And so Nebuchadnezzar figures he's got to make an example of King Zedekiah. So I'm going to just do a quick look up here because there's some fun things about Zedekiah that we can look at. Yeah, ta-da. Because Jeremiah has a bit to say about Zedekiah. I'm going to look it up this way. Yeah. Oh, nope, now I can't find it. Jeremiah recorded a prophecy about Zedekiah that he would not die in the siege, that he was going to survive the siege, and that his own eyes would see the king of Babylon. And so it came to pass exactly how God said. He comes face to face with the king of Babylon, but then he loses his eyes, so he's never going to see anything ever again. And what was the last thing the king of Babylon made him look at? The death of his sons. So he had to watch. Why do you kill off the sons of the king right before his eyes? You got no descendants left. Your dynasty's over. You have nothing left with which to wage war, and all your troublemaking has to be at an end, because now you have no sons to take vengeance. All right? You have nobody left to take your throne. You have nobody left to try and rebel against me to re-secure your dynasty. It's all over. So they put out his eyes, and then they carry Zedekiah off to chains in Babylon. Who else is in chains in Babylon? Jeconiah is still in chains in Babylon. He still has his eyes, by the way. Okay, but Jeconiah is still in chains in Babylon. But now Zedekiah has been let off. So what does that tell us about the line of David's kings? Yeah? Yeah. How does God fulfill his promise now to bring the Messiah if all of Zedekiah's sons are dead? There's a cousin. Okay, if you think back to the Matthew passage, Matthew 1, who does Matthew trace Christ's lineage through? Jeconiah. The adopted brother of Zedekiah. Or, biologically, Zedekiah is Jeconiah's uncle. So it doesn't matter if the line gets cut off here, because you still have Jeconiah and his sons. Now, he was only 18 years old when he was carried away into captivity, but he has plenty of time left in his life to produce sons, and he does. One of his sons will become fairly well known in biblical history. He has a son named Shealtiel, and Shealtiel has a son named Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel is the fellow that Darius Darius is the Persian. Cyrus is the Mede. All right, Darius and Cyrus release Zerubbabel to come back to Jerusalem and rebuild the wall and the temple. Okay, so Zerubbabel is going to be a very important character, and Zerubbabel is a descendant of Jeconiah, not of Zedekiah. So we didn't interrupt the messianic line at all by having these guys cut off. Now, once again, who does Ezekiel use to date his prophecies? Zedekiah's rule or Jeconiah's? He calls him Kaniah in his prophecies, but he uses Jeconiah. He doesn't use Zedekiah. So we can look at it and say that in God's sight, who's still the rightful king of Israel? Jeconiah. He's not sitting on the throne, but he's still the rightful king, because he was probably adopted by Josiah, but he wasn't put on the throne. He should have been, but he wasn't. So Zedekiah is let off. Verse 8, in the fifth month, on the seventh day of the month, that was the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, here's one of these fantastic passages that helps us locate this event in world history. Because now we know the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar is the year that this destruction of Jerusalem happens. And if we can line up the 11th year of Zedekiah with the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar, and the reason these numbers are different here is because the Babylonians reckoned the rules of their rulers just a little different than Judea did, so it's 1 year off. But if we can line up the 11th year of Zedekiah with the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar, then tracing back with all of the information that the book of Kings has given us, we can construct a timeline all the way backwards. And then we get to the founding of the temple by Solomon, and it tells us that it's in the 480th year after the people came out of Egypt. So that helps us make the jump from the building of the temple in Solomon's fourth year all the way back to the Exodus. So we can date the Exodus now. And then using some other passages, we can take things back. One of the amazing things about the Bible is it gives us an uninterrupted history all the way back to the beginning of the world. And we literally can trace the history of the world back to the creation with very little margin of error. You know, you can debate about whether it's 604 BC or 610 BC. You might even be able to push it a little bit beyond that, but you can't take it back to 10,000 BC. There's not enough room in the biblical text for that kind of variation. There might be a few years, maybe a couple of decades, but definitely not centuries and definitely not millennia. So God has given us a history of the world down till the founding of the church. And from the founding of the church until present, we've got a pretty good history kept by other places. Not inspired like the Word of God, but we've got a pretty good history. We can trace the history of the world back to the very beginning. Isn't that an exciting thought? We are not a disconnected group of people that are just floating around in history. Every event that happens to us can be traced back to a causal event beforehand. And we can trace those lines of cause and effect all the way back to the creation. Eldon, go ahead. Yes, they do.
And it's not even reasonable. And they use the carbon 14 dating system, which I don't know where they went wrong, but anyway, I know it's not right. It's way, way, way wrong.
Yeah, the problem with the carbon 14 and all those other chemical measurements is, how do you know what they originally started as? Now, I can measure their chemical makeup today, but how do I know what they originally started as? And how do I know that those elements have decayed at the same rates that they do today? Do I know that the clock didn't run faster or slower at certain points in history? So there's a lot of assumptions that go into those things. But according to what God has given us in His Word, we've got a string of history that runs from the creation all the way up until the latest point we have in history is John, the apostle, alive at the end of the first century, writing the book of Revelation. And that's the last bit of recorded history that we have, but he's writing to seven churches in Asia. So we can trace those things from beginning until that point. And one of the downsides of evolution, I know there's many, many downsides to it, but one of the downsides is it makes people feel hopelessly disconnected from anything important, from any sense of purpose. But the biblical history gives us this sense that you are part of something. God is declaring a story, not a false story, but a real one, as he works out things in history. And the events of history are the outworking of his plan. And he tells us what the end of the plan is. What's the end of the plan, Daniel?
Revelation.
Yes. The revelation with Christ ruling over the world, and then eventually the resurrection and the eternal state. That's the purpose and plan of history. And all of these things are working together in that. So, fifth month, seventh day of the month, which was the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the bodyguard, a servant of the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem. He burned the house of the Lord and the king's house and all the houses of Jerusalem. Every great house he burned down. That temple stood on that place for 500 years. You know, this is hard for us to grasp in America because we don't hardly even have anything in this country that's 500 years old. You know, we trace our beginnings only back a couple of hundred years to the beginning of our country, and only a couple hundred years beyond that to when we even started coming over here as descendants of the Europeans. But here this temple has been standing there representing God and his rule on earth, and now it's gone. It's been destroyed. The Babylonians burn it to the ground. They've already taken everything valuable out of it. Kids and I were having a fun discussion today about where's the ark. Because the last place it's mentioned is in Josiah's reforms. He tells the Levites to put it back in the temple. Because apparently they had been wandering it around to keep it out of the hands of wicked kings. But there's no mention of it made here. When all the other stuff is carried off to Babylon, all the utensils and he's going to talk about breaking down the bronze altars here. When everything's carried off to Babylon, there's no mention made of the ark. So where did that thing go? We don't know. But he burned the house of the Lord, all the king's house, all the houses of Jerusalem, every great house he burned down. And all the army of the Chaldeans who were with the captain of the guard broke down the walls around Jerusalem. And the rest of the people who were left in the city, and the deserters who had deserted to the king of Babylon, together with the rest of the multitude, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried into exile. But the captain of the guard left some of the poorest of the land to be vine dressers and plowmen. They didn't want the land to completely become wilderness, so they did leave a few people to keep the fields, you know, keep the rocks cleared, keep the weeds back, and work the ground. But other than that, everybody else is going off to captivity. Verse 13, the pillars of bronze that were in the house of the Lord. You remember them huge, huge pillars that Solomon made? Massive pillars. The strands of the bronze sea that were in the house of the Lord, the Chaldeans broke them in pieces and carried the bronze to Babylon. I'm surprised those soldiers just didn't hike that bronze pillar up on their shoulders and carry it off. Maybe they could have done it if they'd have those furniture carrying straps that we have now. You just put it underneath, and you know, that way it lifts with your shoulders. Lift those giant bronze pillars. They took away the pots and the shovels and the snuffers and the dishes for incense and all the vessels of bronze used in the temple service, the fire pans and also the bowls. And what was of gold, the captain of the guard took away as gold. What was of silver, as silver. As for the two pillars, the one sea, and the stands that Solomon had made for the house of the Lord, the bronze of all these vessels was beyond weight. The height of the one pillar was 18 cubits, and on it was a capital of bronze. The height of the capital was 3 cubits, a lattice work and pomegranates, all of bronze, were all around the capital, and the second pillar had the same with lattice work. The captain of the guard took Seraiah, the chief priest, and Zephaniah, the second priest, and the three keepers of the threshold. And from the city he took an officer who had been in command of the men of war, and 5 men of the king's council who were found in the city, and the secretary of the commander of the army who mustered the people of the land, and 60 of the men of the people of the land who were found in the city. What do you think he's going to do with these guys? Kill them. Verse 20, and Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, took them, brought them to the king of Babylon at Riblah. The king of Babylon struck them down and put them to death at Riblah in the land of Hamath. So Judah was taken into exile out of its land. This is the end of Israel as an independent kingdom for the next couple hundred years. They have a little revival during the Maccabean period between the Testaments, where Judas Maccabeus restores what's called the Hasmonean kings. But that only lasts until Rome comes in and defeats them. It only lasts about 120 years, I think. And then Rome comes in. And that's the end of the kingdom of Israel. Why? Why did God allow this to happen? Doesn't he love his people? Yeah. This is where holiness and obedience come in. God told his people, you obey me, and I'll bless you. You disobey me, and I'll kick you out of the land. And for 500 years, from the time of the founding of the kingdom at Saul, the nation of Israel has been rebellious. How many of the kings did we see were righteous kings? Not most of them, right? We could go back through and get a count, but... Yeah, the fact that you can get a count is bad. And the ones that were wicked were increasingly more wicked. They kept flaunting God's laws. They kept putting idols into the temple. In fact, when you read Ezekiel, fun passages in Ezekiel, I must be stepping on a bad cable or something. God takes Ezekiel from Babylon to the temple before it's destroyed. And he says, I want you to look around. And Ezekiel starts looking around and he sees monuments to the sun. And he finds altars to pagan gods inside the temple. And he goes around and he sees all the leaders of Israel are worshiping at these altars to foreign gods. And that's after Josiah purged the land. They brought everything back in. And they just would not take what God told them. They wouldn't continue doing what was right. They kept pursuing after other gods. And so we leave them off destitute. You can read the same thing in the end of the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah records a similar thing. And just like when it told us why God had Samaria destroyed, he tells us why he allowed Judah to be destroyed as well. And it's the same reasons. They wouldn't keep his covenant. Now this was a mass illustration. It was an object lesson for the people of Israel. Can you keep God's law? If you really try hard, can you keep God's law? Without ever breaking one part of it, can you keep the entire thing? No. So why did God allow all this?
Why did God allow all this to happen to Israel?
Because he's instructing the world in something. What he wants the world to learn is you are not righteous. You can't be. It's not in your makeup. You are sinners. You are rebellious. And you just continually choose to do wrong. What did God say of the people at the time of the flood? The heart of their imagination is only evil continually. You say, well, that's not a very exciting message. I mean, that's not something I like to hear. Is man basically good? No. Man is not basically good. Man
is wicked to the core. Why tell us that? So that we'd be driven to look to him to save us. To realize the answer is not in ourselves. We can't rescue ourselves out of this problem. We're violators of God's law. We deserve